Hello, everybody. Let's have a meeting, an AA meeting. My name is Lindsley, and I am an alcoholic. Hello. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, that's plural speakers, desperately in need will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Katie H. She happens to be my sponsor. And I'm just going to say quickly that this woman lives a life of recovery and has a program that has convinced me that if I take her suggestions as best as I can, then I have a really great chance at staying sober. I'm excited, and here's Katie.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. My name is Katie Hillman. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, my sobriety date is July the 12th, 2009. And I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, and I sponsor women. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I think that, one of my biggest blessings is that I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it worked for me when nothing else would. So tonight I'm supposed to tell you how I developed a relationship with my higher power and what I was like and what I did, what happened, what got me here, and what it's like now. So I'm going to try my best to do that. So let's see. I was born in Atlanta to two parents who were very loving, gave me tons of opportunity. They were, I probably was their favorite child. I was an easy child. I really was, believe it or not, I don't seem like I would be now, but I was the baby, and I didn't cause too much problems, and I felt like that I was born into a perfect household. I did not know later on to find out that everybody in my family was an alcoholic but my mother. But, you know, when you're born there and you live there, you think it's all normal, you know. So I felt like that I had a great childhood. I played sports very alcoholically throughout my entire life until I started drinking like I did. And I think that that was how I escaped my whatever I was running from. You know, that's how I filled the hole in me. That's how, you know, I felt self-esteem. That's how I felt, you know, loved. And I was a part of things. I was big into sports. I mean, I played, you know, softball. I did gymnastics. I swam. I dove. I did ballet, tap, toe, gymnastics. Jazz. I mean, it was just constant. I was just on the go. Cheerleaded like every single year, football and basketball, all years of high school, and I just love that. When I was in about seventh grade, it was when I first realized about drugs and alcohol and what they could do to your family. My sister had a bad episode with some heavy duty drugs. I think it was like, gosh, I forget what it was now. LSD, maybe? I'm not really sure, but something. And I was in seventh grade, and basically, my parents came home, and they called my brother and I into the laundry room, which is what we had in our house, and they dumped everything out of my sister's purse, and there was so much paraphernalia there and so much stuff there, and they were like, you know, your sister's going away, and they put her in a, you know, West Texas Fairy Mill institution, and we were forced to go visit her, and it was a very bad situation. I mean, it was, it was terrorizing for me as a young child. I was in seventh grade, and I was forced to go there a few times a week, and my sister was in lockdown, and they were drugging her up, and it was just it was a bad situation. And, you know, if a normal person would have seen anybody go through that stuff, I mean, she got shock treatment, and she was screaming, and she was always in, she was in trouble. She was a lot like me, and so she probably was running her mouth and she shouldn't have been. So, like, half the time she was in, you know, solitary confinement, and it was just very, you know, very bad. And, you know, normal people, if that would have happened to somebody in their family, they would have said, you know, whatever caused that to happen, you know, I'm not doing it. But, you know, there were warning signs like that all throughout my life, like we, you know, like it says in the book for Bill. But, So I didn't really start, you know, I think I had a few beers with some friends in seventh grade, and then I sort of lived a double life through high school. I saw what had happened to my sister. It was not a pretty picture. My dad was a full-blown alcoholic by this time, and I was doing really well in high school. Those were the greatest days of my life. I absolutely loved high school. I was, you know, I dated the quarterback, and everybody knew me, and I was popular, and, I mean, I cheated throughout the whole time, so I didn't learn anything, but I had an absolute blast. It was very fun for me. And, you know, I was on the gymnastics team, and just everything was great, you know. And so I lived the double life during those years. My cousins were big partiers, and they would come in every year from Chicago or Pittsburgh, wherever they were living. And they were a couple years older than me, and then my sister and then my brother were older than me. And so we would party, and I loved that. I loved, you know, the feeling of, you know, drinking and getting high. I remember we used to go actually down Craby Drive before it was developed. We lived over off Oak Grove Road, and we would go to Craby because it wasn't developed yet. We'd go to the very end of it. It was a dead-end street, and we would sit there, me and my brothers, my cousin, my sister. We would all just drink and get high and have so much fun. And the cops, they never came. I mean, this was probably 77, 78, 79. I mean, this was a long time ago. And, you know, it was fun way back then, you know. And then my cousins would go back to up north, and my sister and brother would do their thing, and I'd go back to school like nothing happened. And I didn't really have that image there, and I was fine with that because it wasn't really problematic for me at that time. My senior year, I started doing a few things that probably wasn't normal. Me and my best friend, Jennifer, who's still, like, you know, one of my greatest friends, we grew up together since we were, like, two. We would go down to Little Five Points in the morning, and we would buy like a little nickel bag of pot, and we would get a six pack of beer, and we used to shotgun. I don't know if y'all did this when y'all were younger, but the can would be closed, and you would punch a hole in the side of the can and then put it to your mouth and turn it up and like down the whole thing. And I would do that, you know, before y'all were all shaking, a lot of people shaking their head. I would do that before school, and I'd go in my cheerleading outfit, you know, and I had the French braid in the back, and I was like, you know, I probably thought I had arrived, like they talk about Bill, but all I knew was I thought nobody notices, and this is great, and life was good then. I mean, it was fun. We had a good time doing that stuff, me and Jennifer, and we'd sneak out at night, take the cars, and we took her. She went to Purdue to go to college, and one time we drove up there and partied the whole way, and it was just so good. We weren't having any consequences at that time. You know, life was good, and then. After high school, I mean, I'm not kidding when I tell y'all I cheated throughout my entire high school. I learned absolutely nothing. Actually, I got caught cheating on the SAT as well because I scored extremely high because I had the exact score from the wrong test. So I scored like, I don't know, 1600 I think was the best you could score by then. I had like a 1530 on the wrong test. So I had like completely failed. They knew I was cheating, so they confronted me and my parents, and somehow my dad talked him into letting me take it again, and so I ended up landing at the University of Georgia in special studies, and I stayed there for four quarters, which is the max that you can stay there. And what that is you pay full tuition and you get zero credits. And you can't get out until you make a C or better. And so it took me all the four quarters. And I got out of math because I'm halfway decent. I got out of English. It took me a while to get out of history. I still don't know which way is what. Funny story with my husband one time. I insulted somebody on the plane ride telling him he was from this part of the country and he was completely from another country. But so anyway, I finally got out of that, but in Georgia is when I started, like, you know, drinking and partying, and it was just, you know, I mean, I noticed right off the bat I did not drink like other people. Well, first off, you know, I was, like, never studying, and I was drinking every single night. Within the first year, I got my first DUI, I was driving around with a bunch of friends, and I had no car because my sister and brother had totaled cars, so my parents couldn't give me a car. But of course, I told somebody I could drive their car, and I proceeded to drive the car. And we had done some acid that night, and so I really was kind of flipping out in front of the University of Georgia police department when I went there because I was just not in my right state of mind at all. And anyway, I got my first DUI. I got out, and my friends were waiting for me. We started drinking, and it was like I went to work at a topless bar in Athens on the main highway coming in, and I justified it because I said I was just a waitress. I mean, I wasn't up there dancing topless, but, you know, you get the picture. And I saved up my money, and I went to court, and I paid for my DUI, and I thought, I physically fixed this. It's fine. Nobody has to know. Didn't tell mom or dad, all that kind of stuff. Then my drinking really took off, and it got just worse and worse and worse through college. I was in a sorority, and I certainly didn't drink like any of the girls in my sorority. They were like nice girls, and they would have a few, and they would be like, you know, I'm starting to feel it, I'm going to quit, or, you know, that's enough for the night, or whatever. And I always drank till I blacked out. You know, I never intended that. I would always think, I'm just going to drink, you know, a few. But I would always want more because, you know, that whole delay of when it hits you, I was like, you know, I'm not feeling it yet, I'm feeling it yet. I'd want another one, and then I'd be past that point. I always crossed that line. And I would say and do things that I would not normally do. I would get extremely intoxicated and you know, pass out, you know, wake up somewhere, not know where I was. I mean, several times, ended up getting a car. I was going back and forth from the University of Georgia to Atlanta. I worked at Lapeep, and I raised enough money to buy a Mazda 626, and it was my first car. And so anyway, I forgot what I was going to say is what I did. Let me think real quick. Anyway, I stayed at Georgia for 4 years, and during that time, my drinking just got progressively worse. I did more and more things that I, you know, said I would never do. Started trying some different drugs for the first time. Basically, around my fifth year there, I still hadn't graduated yet, and I failed out. I could not, major consequence of alcohol, I could not pass organic chemistry because I'd already been caught cheating in stat a couple times. Letters were sent home. I just couldn't get through. So things were catching up to me, and I had to get out. You know, I was just like, you know, and so anyway, I basically failed out. I was in a horrible relationship with an abusive man. My life was just completely out of control. So I moved home, and I moved in with a drug dealer, actually, and I thought that was a great idea. And my life spiraled bad for, like, probably 22 years old. I was selling drugs down a little 5-point. I was drinking past the point of control every single night. I remember I would wake up many times and I would say, oh my God, I was like, did I drive home last night? And I was like, and I would look out the window and be like, oh, thank God, my car's there. And I would have no recollection of even driving home. And that's how it got to. And that didn't scare me. It wasn't like, okay, you know, you did that. But, you know, you must have a drinking problem. Go get help. That wasn't a thought in my mind. In fact, I talked to my boss today. I told him I was telling my story tonight. And he said, he asked me if I was going to tell him some of the stories of the things that I did at my work. And I told him that, you know, I didn't know if I was or what. And I said, but one thing I do always tell him is that, you know, the guy I've worked for 25 years, he got a DUI. And after he got his first DUI, he was like, you know, I'm never going to drive drunk again. He's like, it's easy. But I can say that I'm going to do that, but I don't ever do that. I always say I changed my mind and I drink too much. And he talked about how he went to DUI school and he learned about how many beers he can have within the hour and that he still does that today. And I'm just like, that is so different. That's what makes me alcoholic and him not. Not the fact that everybody in my family is an alcoholic but my mom, and not because I played sports athletically or whatever it is. It's because my mind is different. You know, I completely think differently. So I ended up failing out. Like I said, things progressed really bad. And in 1992, I hit a bottom that, you know, most people would see be like, that's enough. And it stopped me for a little bit. But I got two back-to-back DUIs. One on November 4th, which was when Clinton was voted into office. I just remember the day because that's what it was. And then again on November 24th, which was Thanksgiving Eve. So I spent Thanksgiving in jail, and both of them in Fulton County. And both of them, same place, towed my car, same place I had lied and said that I was indigent. I had nobody to get me out. So that time I got out on my own reconnaissance. Well, the next time I had to tell the same people. Well, actually, I wasn't telling you the truth. I do need to call somebody to get me out. And my brother, my cousin came and got me out. We went to Macon and saw my mom, and it was a disaster, and I was feeling awful, and I was like, I am never going to do this again. And I got three jobs, and I started doing what we do, you know. I said, you know, I started, you know, I went to court, I checked the things off the list, I said, you know, I'm never going to get another DUI. I drank again on a suspended license for another, like, 2-3 years, because I got sober the first time in 1995, and I was 27 years old, and I had done all that. I had said and done things that I never said I would do. I had tried all the things that a person like me should never try, and I had gotten 3 DUIs, and then my life was a complete mess. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 27, and my life got fabulous. I mean, it got as good as it could get, and I stayed sober for 8 years, which is kind of funny, because I'm just now coming up on 9, and all I really did, to be honest with you, is go to AA meetings and not drink. Although, that was a lot for someone like me, because when you take the alcohol away from me and any kind of drugs, I'm not that mean anymore. I always have been the kind of person that does what I says I'm going to do, you know, and I've always been fairly honest. I mean, I didn't even have any financial amends to anybody. I mean, if I owed you something, I paid it and all that. So I was bearable when I was an Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, but I didn't get a relationship with my higher power, and I didn't realize that God is doing all this stuff for me, and I just can't. I came into Nava, I came into Biscayne, I was there all Biscayne all the time. Came into, you know, Galano, went to all the clubhouses, went to meetings. They got a sponsor the very first year or two, and then, you know, that ended. No one really asked me that. I mean, I would share in meetings like I knew what I was talking about. I was probably offensive and egocentric and not very attractive, but that's what I did, and that was my story. I mean, I did that for 8 years, and because I wasn't drinking and using, some of the outside stuff got really good. You know, I continued to work for this company. They didn't know when they first hired me I was an alcoholic. They didn't really know what was wrong with me while I was drinking during the, I only started there in 92. So I only had 3 years of drinking with them before I got sober for 8. So they had just recently put me in sales, and so it took off. You know, I started making big money and buying houses and cars, and, you know, everything was coming my way. I mean, it really was, just like Bill says in it. I mean, I've really felt like, you know, when I laugh when I read that, you know, the banker was skeptical because he was whirling fat checks my way, you know. That's the way I felt like, because I always was bragging about it, because I felt so much like it was something I was doing. I felt like, you know, I even would say in meetings to myself, you know, I mean, basically what I'll tell you is that when I was 35 years old, I was at a meeting and I thought, I got nothing in common with these people. I said, they're a bunch of losers, and if my life was like theirs, I'd drink too. And, you know, look what I got. I mean, that was basically the way I was. That's the way I felt. And I went out to a company thing. Not my company workers weren't with me, but it was a company function for the career path I'm in. It was other people in my career. I don't know how to say it. So I drank that night. I came home and I lived with my cousin, and he didn't notice. And I thought, you know, I made way too much of this thing. I am not an alcoholic. I mean, come on. I had 2 beers, I had 2 glasses of wine, came home, nothing happened. A few days passed, did it again, nothing happened. Except for I got away with it. I came home and I was like, you know, no one's noticing, you know. I mean, I couldn't have been an alcoholic at 27. This is great. I can drink again. Well, family wasn't so, they were pretty skeptical about the whole idea, and I hid it from them for a while. But what happened was within 2 weeks, I was completely blacking out, and I was drinking where I had no control over it. I would say, I'm only going to drink a little bit tonight. I would always stop by the liquor store, and I would always drink. And I was coming in and out of meetings. I remember coming here on a speaker meeting Monday night, and I was like, yeah, I'm one of those people that is constitutionally incapable, because my ego was so involved. I thought, I cannot do this. I am a failure. I am such, because that's the way I judged anybody else that was doing it, you know. And I was like, I am such a failure. I used to say, you know, you're a winner or a loser in here. You either don't, you drink or you don't. I had no understanding that I was not in control, and I had no power over the fact not to drink. And it took me 6 years of out there doing what I did to learn how powerless I was and how I was beyond human aid. And I didn't know those things. I always thought, if I tightened up my bootstraps and I, you know, exercised all my self-discipline, and I did as my daddy taught me, I could do anything. And the truth was that I struggled for 6 years. I ended up getting a 4th DUI, and I lost my license, and so I could not drive for 6 months. I wasn't that versed in what people do when they get DUIs, because I'd been sober for a long time, and I didn't know you're supposed to look at the back of the ticket and call right away so you don't automatically lose your license. If anybody needs to know that, there you go. I turned it over and it was in light gray. It pissed me off because I was like, why didn't they put that in dark, you know? But I was dealing with my dad who had just had a stroke. And I was like, I'll deal with my DUI later. I'll deal with my DUI in about 20 days after my DUI. I turned it over And I read it, and I'm like, oh, my God. I was like, my license has been suspended. And I remember I'd stayed late at work, and I called, and I got this lawyer, and I was like, paid a lot of money. And I was like, do whatever. Just keep me on the road. You know, just keep me on the road. And I was going to fix this. You know, I want to be out of jail, and I want to get on the road. And he's like, well, I have like a $5,000 retainer, and he can talk to me. And I'm like, what's a good time? So I went, and I met with him, and he said, girl, I didn't know you had three DUIs for this. He said, I can't keep you out of jail and on the road. He's like, that's going to be impossible. He said, and you're already off the road. Your license is suspended. And so I was like, yeah. So I managed to make, he said, do me a favor. He said, don't get a DUI until we get you to court. He said, don't drive on your suspended license and don't get a DUI until I get you to court. And I remember coming in one time and telling somebody in AA, I said, I have, you know, 221 more days before I can drink and drive. I mean, that's like the way, I mean, I was just so delusional. And so I ended up going to the lawyer, and I did not get picked up driving without a license. Although I did drive without a license, I was dealing with my dad who had a stroke, and I was trying to take Antabuse, and I have funny stories about taking Antabuse, but they're really not funny because it's a horrible thing to take if you're drinking. And what the problem is that you cannot drink for 3 or 4 days and then take the Antabuse and think, oh, this is not going to hurt me. Well, I was at a Falcons game, and I had complete double vision, and my face turned bright red in my neck, and the guy was with us like, oh my God. He's like, what's wrong with you? I mean, I was just like exploding because I had taken during the break, I told him I had to go to the bathroom, and I ran up there and I got a big pint of beer, and I ran between one of the cubbies and I downed a whole pint, got another one, downed a whole pint, and I sat in my seat, and all of a sudden the Antabuse started working. It had been like 3 days and all this double vision, and I was sweating, and it was awful. And Ken was his name, and he carried me out of the stadium, and I had to stop and pause, and I lied to him and said I'd go to the bathroom, and I ran into the bathroom, did a little line of coke. I thought that might help. I mean, so ridiculously insane. That's how I was. I think it did help a little bit, but when I got home, I was sweating, and he made me a cold bath. And then when I got in the cold bath, I was like, I'm freezing, and it was just an awful experience. But you know what? I did it again 3 weeks later. I went to see my dad at the nursing home, and I went next door to there's a liquor store next to Briarwood right there on La Vista Road. I biked there because I wasn't going to drive, so I biked. And so I biked to the see my dad at Briarwood Nursing Home because he had a stroke, did his exercises, so he'd walk again, went next door, got a bottle, went over to the Dunkin' Donuts, thought that I'd wait a little bit because it had been a few days on the Antabuse, biked home from that, and it woke up 3 hours later off the sidewalk on Briarcliff Road. I was in the bushes, and I dragged my bike. I can't even drive a bike. And, you know, I'm wondering when I can drive and drink again. And I wake up, and I got, you know, my backpack with me, and I see the bottle of liquor, and I realize what's happened, and I look around. I'm like, nobody noticed. I'm like, this is cool. And I like, get on my bike, and I go home, and I down some more liquor. I mean, it's just so insane. The insidiousness of this and the insanity that surrounds this is totally crazy to think that I was that person. And I was, and I did that sort of crap without telling y'all all the stories for 6 years. It was awful. I ended up going to long-term treatment. I went to Peachford twice. I was in an alcoholic coma where my mother had to come to the hospital and see me that way. And then I continued to drink in the mornings and went into my work and did the same thing. And so that was one of the things my boss asked me if I was going to tell y'all, is he remembers the story so much better than me because I blacked out. But I drove my car to work, and evidently I hit the sign in our neighborhood on my way out. So, which is so funny because I sell signs for a living. And that's what I did, is I hit our sign going out. I have since sold them a nice looking sign to enter our neighborhood made of granite. So I hope I don't hit that one. But I hit this old wood thing, and it scratched the whole side of my car, which I didn't even remember this until he told me today. But I pulled on into work, and when I pulled in, I had two flat tires. And Craig looked out and said, what is the hell is she doing with two flat tires? And he just shook his head or whatever. And he went to tell me I had two flat tires, and I was asleep on my daytimer. I had already fallen asleep. It was about 9:15 in the morning, and I was passed out completely drunk from vodka that I was downing in the morning. And I did this almost every morning, but just some mornings it would affect you differently, which I never could understand that. I was just like, I don't understand. I always took a glass that high, and I always filled it up that much, downed it with my whole plug in my nose. Then I'd walk my dog and go to work, and I didn't usually drink again until break or lunch. And so, but this time it hit me differently, and I was completely passed out on my daytimer. And one would think that might be enough, since I was at a very, I was earning a very good living, and I was the sales manager, and this company could have easily said, you know, you're out of here. And I told him I was going to AA, and he visited me in Peachford. And I remember we had a beer machine in my old work, which is always kind of funny. I give him hell about this. Is he came to, he had 5 o'clock, people that are normal drinkers can drink in my old job. We had a beer machine. So he had a couple of beers, and then he said, "Bye, guys, I'm going to go visit Katie at Peachford." So he said, it didn't dawn on him until I came out to Peachford and chat with him, and I go, "Have you been drinking?" I was like, "I'm in detox." And so we laughed today at that, because he just doesn't think like that, because he's a normal drinker. He's like, "Yeah, I just had one with the boys before I came up here," you know. But I thought it was funny. But about you know, 3 months later, I knew it was getting pretty bad. I knew I needed to do something, but I didn't know what, because I'd been coming to AA, but I hadn't been doing everything in AA. I was on the fringes, you know. I was on the outskirts. I was just doing the, you know, sharing, you know, "I can't stop drinking, and you don't understand, you know, I'm more powerless than y'all." And, you know, I was a mess in meetings. I don't know if any of y'all were here, if y'all remember it. I know Rusty might have been here, but I was a mess. And so I guess the last straws is I went to work again, and I passed out drunk, and this time I fell on the floor and I was completely out. I didn't wake up. So they called my mother, and they called the guy that I was sleeping with that lived two doors down from me, and he came up, and they both came in, and my mom was just devastated, and she was at the time on a cane, and she was just like, you know, "What has happened to my baby?" And it was just awful, because I'd done so much. I kept her up sleepless nights, and it still makes me upset. But so she's 83 today, and she's got to see me be sober for almost 9 years this time. But it was a bad situation. So I said, "I'll go to treatment if you hold my job." I was still so full of ego. I'm like, "I'll go get help if you hold my job." They're probably like, "Whatever." So I went to treatment for 4 months, and I would love to say that was the last time I drank, but I actually relapsed once in treatment and once when I got out, and then I got sober for the last time. And when I got out the last time was, again, one of the worst ones. I'd broken into my neighbor's house and stole a huge bottle of vodka and drank it all until I was in a coma. And my brother found me, and I had to go in, you know, in ambulance to the hospital. And so I've qualified that I cannot, you know, as much as I tried to come in here and, you know, do half measures, it did not work. And I you would think that someone that their whole life got so much better. If I was just a hard drinker, I would have never picked up again, because I had a lot of things back. I mean, it wasn't just material. Family was happy with me. I mean, I was dating. I wasn't marrying. Nobody wanted to make that commitment, but I was dating. And so when I came in here the last time, I actually came in with my roommate from, I had gone to Talbot's, and I came in with my roommate, and I was at a Peachford meeting, and my sponsor today was sharing, and I had seen her at a couple other meetings in the area, like the last couple of weeks. It was so weird. The last two meetings I went to, this girl was there. So I go there, and I see her, and I was like, listen to what she said. And my friend was like, "Ask her to be your sponsor." And I was just like, "Oh, you know, I don't know about all that." And so I went over to her, and I was, and she was like, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I was like, "No." And she's like, "I'm your sponsor." And I'm like, "Okay, great. Thank you." And she said, "You know, I need you to do a couple of things." And I had never had a sponsor give any kind of direction. And I don't mean to say that those things don't exist at the places I was going, but I never had someone say, "I'm going to be your sponsor, and this is what you do." And I was taken a bit back, but I was like, "Well, okay." I mean, I was desperate. I was swollen and nasty and in trouble all the time, and about to lose my job, and my soul was aching. It was bad. So I said, "Okay, what?" And she was like, "You know, basically you got to join the home group." And I'm like, "Oh God, this sounds very serious, you know." And she says, "I'm fixing to open up a home group. It's right up the street." She said, "I'm opening up a home group." I said, "Where is it?" She said, "Well, it's at Brockwood United Methodist Church." And I said, "Oh, I went to kindergarten there." She says, "Oh, is it close to your house?" I said, "Yes, about a half a mile." She goes, "Good, I'll see you on Thursday." And she was like, "And if you don't like that, you can join another one, but you have to join a home group." And I was like, "Okay, I can do that." So I went, and it wasn't very big then. It was the tradition group. It wasn't a very big group then, and it was good. And she said, "I'll take you through the book once a week." And she said, "You know, I'm going to take you through the book, and then when you're done, you'll have to stay on the sponsor." And I was like, "Okay, that'll be a long time away. I'm not good at that kind of stuff. I'm not going to do that, you know, but okay, I'll say I will." And you got to, you know, pray to God a couple times a day, and you got to, you know, do what I ask you to do, service work and stuff. So I was like, "That's not that bad. Okay, I'll do it." And we eased into it. She wasn't actually as hard as she seems when we, when this direction was given to me, at least not how I remember it.
And so I started doing it, and immediately, I mean, I felt a part of, and I think I was just ready. I felt a part of. I remember before 6 months, we had Tom I coming to speak at our group, and I didn't have 6 months yet, but I raised my hand to be the speaker chair on Saturday night, and they voted me in, and I was like, can I do it in all 6 months? I'm like, yeah, you can do it. And I was like, you know, and I just immediately felt like, you know, I feel a part of this, and I feel like I fit in, and I didn't feel like I fit in before. I felt like I was a loser because I was coming in, I wasn't getting what y'all were getting. And so I just stayed, and I just was consistent about doing all the things she asked me to do. And I didn't sponsor for a long time, probably 2 years. I used to make fun of my friend Melissa. I'd be like, you know, you guys could do all that stuff. That's for y'all. I'm not doing that. I do not want anyone calling me. I'm not doing that. And it was really fierce. I didn't think I'd be any good at it. But what happened is, you know, I think Kathy said to me once, you're not in charge of who you sponsor. If someone asks you, you say yeah. And then I was like, and then she's like, but you got to stand up. And I stood up, and she looked over. She's like, don't worry. Nobody's going to ask you right now after what you've been saying. And so nobody did ask me for a long time. And when they did, it was like I was just having maybe, you know, maybe I had 10 girls that would make it a little bit and then they quit. Because you know how lots of people are like that. And I might have one that stayed that I took through a lot. And then little by slow, I started, you know, sponsoring more women. And the more I did it, the more I liked it. And I realized everything that they say about it, that's like the spark of AA. That is like the good infusion that you get, or the, like we used to take a, you know, a shot of liquor or something. That's where you get that. I mean, it really wakes up and it lights up my life when I'm sitting across from somebody and I'm working with them. And then later, when they get better and their life gets better, you know, and I get to see their blessings come true and their life get better, you know, it's equally heartbreaking when they don't do the stuff and you see them die or you see them go out. But it has helped me way more than I've helped them. And, you know, and I would have never known that if I didn't stick around. And I needed to be with a sponsor that was rigid like that, and with a group that required you to do a lot of things, like come early and set up and clean up and all that. I used to love walking in here. I'm late everywhere I go, including work for 25 years. I would come in this meeting, I'd walk in like it's a grand entrance, 5 or 10 minutes late, find my seat and sit down and look over at people and judge them. And now I got to get there early and set up chairs. I mean, it's a whole different thing, you know. And now I don't do that anymore. I mean, I will tell you that because of praying to God and seeing Him help me through experiences, I don't even think that way anymore. I mean, it's changed my thinking. It's changed what I do. I mean, you know, a couple of examples was I remember when I got on my knees the first time and asked God to get sober, and, you know, and I was like, because I felt like I was going to drink after about 6 months, and I was told, get on your knees, and I got on my knees, and I was just like, God, help me. And I remember crying. I was like, because I don't think I can do this. And it was removed for a long period of time. I don't know how long, but it came back, but it was removed because I had asked, and I don't know how that works, and I love to know how and why something works. I have no idea why it works, but I just know I was able to go out and do have my day and not be obsessed with thinking about drinking. Because I was always under the impression that I would drive home and be like, my car would go like this into the liquor store. But that was just a joke. The truth is I drove my car in there, you know, and I was, you know, I was powerless to do anything different because I wasn't tapped into a power, you know. I was completely like trying to do it Katie's way and be like, all right, everybody's off my back, and, you know, I'll tell Mom I'm going to bed early, and I'll just get a little bit of liquor, and I would go home, and I would drink, and then that would awake that beast inside of me. And the next day, I felt so remorseful, and I'd be like, I knew, you know, I couldn't really go in and go, I need my 6 months, so a few days would pass by, and I'd come back up to the podium and pick up a white chip again. And, you know, it's been so much more graceful these last 8 or 9 years doing it the way that it was suggested to me. I really have a fulfilled life now. I mean, when I it didn't all happen, it hasn't all been the roses. I mean, I've since I've been sober, my brother died suddenly of a heart attack, my father's passed away, I've had other hardships, you know, a lot of them, but for the most part my life's been filled with joy. I mean, I'm pretty happy most of the time. I am a good worker. I don't, you know, I still show up a little bit late, but they really do like me there, and I do a good job for them when I'm there, and I don't take lunches, which I think helps, even though he's not sold on that idea. But, I mean, you know, I was the first, you know, shortly after I got sober, I think it was about 8 months after I got sober, I met my now husband. He was about 4 months sober, and we went to our sponsors, and they said, you know, they said, you know, actually my sponsor and her husband knew Trey from the past. He had been sober from before, and they were like, we love him. They're like, he's a free spirit, great guy. They're like, date him. They're like, just, you know, it's not like you're marrying him. And I was like, yeah, I go on a date with him, you know. And so I did, and you know, we ran everything by our sponsors, and I did my amends, and I got through the steps, and it was a whirlwind, man. It was awesome. But he was big into AA, and that was helpful, and I was too. And 2 weeks after we started dating, he surprised me at a AA conference down in Cocoa Beach. I was with some of my best friends there, and they all knew about the surprise, and I didn't. And he surprised me, and about 5 months later, he proposed. So we got married 10 months after we met. Didn't have a lot of time. I think I had maybe a year and 4 months, and he had a year. And we've now been married over 7 years. And for the most part, we have a very good marriage. I mean, we'll argue about something here and there, but that's normal. I mean, we laugh, and he's my best friend. I mean, we have so much fun together. And in fact, I was looking around this room, and I didn't orchestrate any of this at all. In fact, I had no idea Lindsley was even coming. We spoke nothing of it, and then she showed up, and then Tim said, can you get somebody to chair the meeting? And I was like, and you know, Lindsley's one of my sponsors that I've seen grow and change so much, and it's just amazing how things work when you don't plan them, and you let God work in your life. I mean, I was dating this guy right before I met Trey, and I remember I was at an AA convention, and this guy, Matt Royal, some of y'all might know him, I was at the coffee thing, and I was dating this guy who was really a nice guy, and he said, so how's Ronnie, was his name? I said, he's fine. I was like, but, you know, he's, we're, you know, it's this and it's that, and he goes, well, you never can meet the right guy if you're dating the wrong guy, and I was like, huh. And I thought, yeah, but this guy was a millionaire, and he was decent looking, and he was funny, and my mom loved him, and I thought, well, he is the wrong guy. But I was so, like, you know, I thought I had to just, you know, I just didn't even, I thought I was so desperate, you know. I was just like, this is new, this is different. So we broke up, and if I would not have done that, if he didn't say that, and I didn't go to my sponsor about that, I would have never met Trey, and I, you know, wouldn't have him. That was a complete God thing, you know. And I mean, I had a flat tire, which is how I met Trey. If I didn't have a flat tire, I would have met Trey. So how does all that work, right? And you know, today I'm employed at the same job. I have better friends than I've ever had in my life. This time in my life is probably as good as the high school years. It's just easy to look back and remember really good times. But if I were honest, I'd say that the friends I have now and the things I do in my life are immeasurable. I mean, they're so good. And I can remember everything. And I can enjoy it. And I can, I mean, seriously, some of my very best friends are in here tonight. You guys all know who you are. And, of course, my husband and the other guys here that came out. And, you know, I get to live a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. I mean, one time I don't want to say Bermuda because it wasn't Bermuda, but I was going somewhere. And anyway, I got drunk in the airport and I missed my flight. And I remember sitting down and I remember looking up, and it's like something you read in a damn book. I mean, the big boots of all the people that work there kind of nudged me a little bit. And I woke up and they said, move along. And I thought, you are nothing more than like a homeless old woman drunk. I'm like, here you are in the airport. You've missed your flight and you're told to be moved along, you know, move along. I mean, if someone told me that now, I'd be like, you know, what, you know, and then the irony of it is that I'm leaving a week, let's see, no, not a week tonight, I'm leaving Friday night, to go to South Africa with my very good friend Barbara and my husband Trey, and we're going to Istanbul and Mozambique and all these places, and I couldn't even have a driver's license to drive a car or get on a plane that was going to fly for me when I was drinking. And now I have freedom, you know. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous provided me freedom to live a good life and be there for my mother, who is absolutely amazing. You know, my mom is 83, and I just moved her into Kingsbridge, and seeing how she's flourishing and doing well just brings me so much joy. And it's like, you know, I couldn't have done that drinking, you know. I would be on the floor, you know. I barely could take care of my dad. I mean, Barbara can tell you stories about that. But, you know, it's amazing how we can be there for the people that love us now. We can be a friend. We can be an AA member. We can be a good wife. You know, you learn so many things in AA, like, you know, it's not 50-50 in a relationship. It's 100%, 100%. I'm like, shit, I hate that. You know, I want to give 50 and make sure he gives 50. That's how I came in here. I'm a scorekeeper. And then I learned in AA, you know, you give 100%, you'll get back so much more. And it's so true, you know. And
Just all the things that I learned in AA. Most of my education's been in here, because as I told y'all, I didn't have one before. So, I can't remember if I'm forgetting anything or not, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it saved my life, and I think I can keep doing this thing with the help of my sponsor, my friends, a God, working with others, and my sweet, loving husband. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Katie. Says, say something positive and keep it short. That's my sponsor. And it is that passion and energy and authenticity that inspires me and encourages me. So I hope it touched y'all in some way tonight moving forward. So thanks again, Katie. We have asked Mr. Trey to come up and hand out the chips, please.
Trey Hillman, alcoholic. We have a chip system. You want to change somebody's tire and get married? We got a white chip for you. All right. Anybody else on a white chip? All right. After 30 days, we have a silver chip. I got 30 days. All right. After 90 days, I have a red chip. Everybody got 90 days. All right. After 6 months, we have a yellow chip. Everybody got 6 months. All right. And then after 9 months, we have a green chip. All right. And after a year, we have a blue chip. Anybody got a year? All right. Hey.
Do it, mister.
Yes. And who are you?
Yeah, Jordan Alcoholic.
Yes, Jordan.
It's 2 years. For the alcoholic junkie that came in here, to the man I can be today and the life I have, it really was nothing but a miracle. This program really, really does work. All you have to do is be willing to take some suggestions regardless of how you feel about it. And I'm just thankful each day that I got beat up enough to be willing to do something different that wasn't my idea before I died. And now life is truly amazing, and all it took was getting a sponsor, working the steps, and asking for help to find my way to this power that I don't have on my own that has really changed my life. That's it. Thanks.
Anybody else can bleach it? All right. Yeah.
Hey, Joe Jennings, alcoholic.
Yeah.
And this is 14. And I want to start by thanking you, Katie, for your story. It was fabulous, like it always is. So that was very touching. But yeah, for me, best year ever. They keep getting better and better. I think for those of you that know me, I started off rough. My mom passed my first year of sobriety. My brother OD'd my second year. My sister OD'd my third year. I wasn't a happy camper at first, but everyone's doing well. Two out of my three kids are in the program. Third one's qualifying. Things are looking good. Thanks.
Anybody else for a blue chip? All right. The clapping woke you up, and you might reconsider on a white chip. Anybody want a white chip? All right. Congratulations on the chips you have.
Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight. Thank you.
somewhere strange to me. As I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the